Oh, hi, my name's Linda and I'm an addict. Hello, everyone. Take my glasses off because I can't really see you now and I feel safer. That tickled me, the sausages and sparklers, and quite often I'm the only person to laugh at things, and I'm glad half the room did as well because now I don't feel so odd. I'm really grateful to be here this evening. I was asked yesterday by my sponsor, so I haven't had weeks to worry about what I'm going to say, you know, just not much sleep last night. Why I'm really glad to be here is because I got a letter yesterday in the post from my housing association saying, you owe us near on £2,000. What's happening? You know, can you get in touch with the housing benefits people and blah, blah, blah. So that brought up some anxiety and I thought, oh shit, what's going on now? And I'm going to have to run up and down the benefits office. And I hate that because I like pretending that I don't have to do that shit because it's like grown up and responsible and I just can't bear it. I just like my own little bubble. So anyway, I did what I do now is just do things even though I don't like doing them. Pick the phone up, phone the town hall, and there was a big pause on the other end when I explained what had happened and what was in the letter. And this guy said, oh, I'm really, really sorry, it's our mistake. Bear with me. And I heard him sort of go, oh, shit. Sort of under his breath, and I said, is it really bad then? And he went, yeah, bad as it can get. I said, what, like I'm dead? And he said, well, yeah. So honestly, it spun me out. They have mixed me up with somebody, and then he said, I'm going to put you onto my boss. And he put me onto his boss, this woman who was groveling. She couldn't have been more apologetic, and she apparently I died in mid-September. And and that was that. But do you know what? I kind of laughed and went, well, it's all right. We all make mistakes and they've got her name was completely different to mine. Her name was Sonia something. So completely different to Linda. But I think it was our national insurance numbers that were kind of similar and someone fucked up anyway. But I put the phone down and I burst into tears. I thought, oh my God, this is how deep I go, right? I thought, oh my God, if I was really dead, my flat would just be like this, and this is what would happen. They would just like stop everything, and then the flat would be cleared out, and then I wouldn't have existed, and it's all this. And I went into one for about 10 minutes, and then I phoned my older sister, who I'm really close to, who knows me, and she went, it is not an omen. That's the first thing she said to me, because I'm a worrier. People don't know that about me. You know, I put this hard face on, but actually, I worry a lot. I'm a bit of a fretter and a worrier, and I don't like to admit that. Well, I don't really care much anymore what I admit. You all know me inside out. Anyway, so that was today, and it was odd. It's thrown me. It's put me in an odd. I'm going to have to put these on because I just feel like I'm tripping. Hello. Hello. Right. So anyway, so that's how my day started. It was lovely to hear you. It was really lovely to hear you and lovely to see you sitting there because I remember when before you got clean and you were trying and it's, you know, it's remarkable, isn't it? It's remarkable for all of us, you know. I came into this fellowship 15 years ago. I was worked out, we've done 68 years using between us because I used for 31 years. I used from a young teen. I grew up, my father was in the army and we moved a lot. I lived in Hong Kong, I lived in Germany, I lived in Kent, I lived in Worcester, Gloucester and Brecon, where I'm from, a place called Crickowell in the sort of hillbilly, I'm a hillbilly. Because of that, all that moving around, I thought that's why I always felt like I didn't fit in. And I thought that was why. And then it wasn't until I came into this fellowship and I heard everybody else say that. Oh, you know, I didn't feel comfortable in my own skin. I don't feel like I fit in. And I thought, oh my God, that's me. Because I didn't identify with people's using when I came in. Because I'd been a heroin addict as a teenager, and it was intravenous, and I used to score in Piccadilly, and I used to use in phone boxes all around here, and I used to clip and mug people and do all of that at 17 years old. And I'd kind of run away from Wales, where my family was just really dysfunctional, and I was chronically unhappy, and a baby addict. I'd been jumping out the bedroom window for a couple of years and running off to parties and taking magic mushrooms and booze in and sleeping around, and consequently I got pregnant at 16, was whacked into a mother and baby home run by nuns, and had this child. And my parents, who were divorced at the time, kind of both thought it was best for me to have him adopted. So he was adopted at birth. And I kind of blamed all of my using after that on that event. You know, me being an addict on that event. But actually, I realise now that, you know, it was my behaviour that caused that in the first place. And if I hadn't been running around like I was and looking for excitement everywhere that I could, it was so fucking boring in Wales in the 70s. You had to do something. I mean, Jesus Christ, if it hadn't have been for drugs, I'd have jumped off a mountain years ago. So, you know, it was like, oh, it was grey, it was grim. And then David Bowie came on the telly, and then magic mushrooms, and oh, and boy. Oh God, it was heaven. But like with all of us, I kind of hammer things. So I got into a lot of trouble early on. I was always getting nicked. I was the one always being brought home. My dad had a pub then. He'd come out of the army by then, and he had a pub, and I was always getting nicked and brought home by the police. And yeah, proper what they used to call delinquent, juvenile delinquent. And anyway, I, at that time, you know, I did seem like it was all fun, and, but it really was a way of managing how I felt, I think, because I never knew, and I find it difficult now to know how I feel at the time. It takes me sometimes days to catch up with how I feel, or events that have happened. You know, like I nearly got killed earlier this year. I was pinned up against a parked car by a bus, and I was kind of like, oh, yeah, you know, I nearly died then, but it was a couple of days later when I was like, fuck, you know, I know I'm not supposed to swear, am I? So it takes me time with this stuff. I don't always know how I'm feeling, and I really didn't know how I was feeling. My family was out of control, I was out of control, and I was really, really hurt. And I kind of, I don't know, there was two, honestly, this is going to sound like it's a funny story, but it's not. There were two gay guys in my village, and me and them ran away together. Me and the only two gays in my village left, and we went, we decided to go picking grapes in France, but we were going to hitchhike down through, we were going to the Hook of Holland, and then we were going to hitchhike down through Amsterdam, get a load of weed first, as you do, and then go off down to France. That didn't happen. I got deported at the docks. I didn't have enough money. I'd spent all my money before I got there. So they said they didn't believe that I wasn't going abroad to work, so they made me sign this thing saying I'll pay SeaLink ferries the money to send me back, and they deported me back. And I ended up on Holland Park Avenue with my two gay friends, sitting on our bags, and this American guy called Bud, I kid you not, came and he said, are you looking for somewhere to stay? And we went, yeah, and he took us to this, my first night in London was in a place called Tent City, which was on Little Scrubs, if anyone knows Little Scrubs, but Tent City back then, and that was my first night fighting this bloke out of my sleeping bag, because, you know, I was a little pretty slim thing back then, and so that was my first night, and then this Bud took us to this mansion in Holland Park, and I ended up living there in a squat there for 9 months, and then that's where I met the dealers, and a little bit after that was where I met a load of scousers, and I've had conversations with Ronnie. We know some of the people that taught me to shoplift are the people that Ronnie knows from Liverpool. So there you go, there's a connection. There's a connection. And the fella of one of the women who taught me to shoplift is sitting over there. So there you go. So that's how I spent the next few years, smacking my bitch up and nicking fur coats in Harrods and Selfridges. And yeah, please don't give my last name away. I've never made amends for this shit. So it's, I'm not going to go in and go, here's your fur coats back. Yeah, and that's how I kind of spent the late 70s and early 80s. And then I had a a daughter. I had my daughter, and I didn't want to lose another child. And I knew, even though I didn't really know, but I knew in the back of my head that I was, you know, that was very painful. That was a trauma that I'd gone through. And I didn't want to lose my daughter. And through the help of my older sister, I kind of came off the heroin in her place, in her house. She looked after me. And, you know, I adore her. I love her to bits. And I never went back to the smack after that. I kind of, but I because of that, I thought I was clean. I really did think I was clean, and I spent the next sort of 20 odd years just having a pill for a feeling. So if I wanted to clean my flat, I'd take Speed. If I was going out, I'd take Coke. If I wanted to relax, I'd take Valium. If I wanted to sleep, I'd take sleeping pills. And there was spliff and there was booze. And it was always a guy as well. And that's how the next couple of decades of my life went by. And then my daughter kind of grew up, and, you know, I was a single parent. Most of that time was really fucking boring. And I watched, do you know what I saw today? I saw Thriller, the video, for the first time in donkey's years, with Michael Jackson, you know, all of that jazz. And I looked at it, and I remembered when that came out, and I remembered that I was having massive panic attacks at the time, and I couldn't sleep in my own bedroom. I had a two-bedroom flat, and I was a single parent. My daughter was three. And I was having massive panic attacks because of all the drugs and the untreated traumas and stuff that you touched on, Ronnie. And I remember being having to sleep in my daughter's bedroom, and her cot was there, and I had my bed squashed in, and there was a telly there because I was painting downstairs as well at the same time. And that video came on, and I was so terrified. When he looked up and his eyes went like, I was so scared that I was stuck in the corner of my bed, and my daughter was over there in her cot sleeping. And I just remember sobbing and breaking my heart. I was so lonely. I was so frightened, and I was so scared. And it was just, you know, something as simple as a fucking music video. And that's how I spent decades, being really terrified. If anybody said to me, how do you feel? I wouldn't have known at the time, to be honest. I was so shut down, I just wouldn't have known how I felt. Now I can look back and I know that I was always terrified. Always. I was always scared of everything. And so, you know, that was all of that. And anyway, my daughter kind of grew up, moved out. You know, she moved in with her boyfriend, and I don't blame her. You know, she was quite young when she left home, but I started working in a pub, and the coke had got quite bad. And then I met this toy boy who was gorgeous. He was 15 years younger than me, and he had a pocket full of drugs, and I moved him in. And he had lots of stamina as well, so I was well happy. Anyway, so me and him did what you do together when you're both addicts, and that's we went downhill together really rapidly. The crack came in. And I was about 6 years on all that shit. And I spent the last couple of years, I was working in brothels, then answering the phones in knocking shops, you know, selling other people's bodies. It's kind of really fucking scummy when you think about it, you know, but I didn't even consider that, you know. It was just, I'd go in and go, oh, you've got a lovely young lady here today, 36, 24, 36, blah, 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 you know. And then, yeah, that's what I did to earn this money. So I was earning about, you know, I was on about between 500 and 700 quid a week. It was good money, so I was able to look after my daughter, decorate my flat, you know, dress myself, and go out. And so a lot of that money went on crack and clothes and, you know, partying. And but the last couple of years of that, I just remember I had moved by then to the flat that I'm in now, and I live quite near to Kensington Gardens. I live up by Notting Hill Tube Station, up by at that area. And I spent 2 years before I came into recovery, maybe more, all I can remember is 2 years really, walking around that park crying, wanting to be out of that relationship. We'd split up and get back together every fortnight, every 10 days, every week. You know, it was just an addictive relationship, and it was hell, and my whole life was misery and hell, and I was lying to everybody. I didn't go to family events because I always had a migraine. Oh, I can't today, I'm feeling ill, or I can't, I'm working. You know, I didn't, my life was just me, my ex, drugs, my flat, and whatever we could do to get money to use. And, you know, it was, Yeah, it was pretty shitty. I've got a friend called Pete. Pete is in the other fellowship. He's in AA. And I remember thinking, I need to do something spiritual. Selling other people's bodies is not spiritual. This is what will save me. I'll get a job and I'll make a difference. I'll do something. I've got a job in a charity shop. If anyone's ever thinking about earning lots of money, get a job in a charity shop, because they don't take inventory, so you can sell what you fucking want if the manager's not there and earn a fortune. And that's what I was doing. So I was like, I'd be in work hanging on like this, where I'd been up all night praying. I'm an atheist, kind of. Sometimes I'm agnostic. When I sit on a plane, I'm a total believer. But I am, honestly. Sit my ass on a plane, I'm like, I'm really sorry, God, for everything I've ever done. I love you. Please don't let me die today. Anyway, so I got this job in the charity shop, and I ripped them off rotten, and I got caught nicking from this place by a mystery shopper. It's a fabulous title, isn't it? Mystery shopper. I just feel like they're a bit like Harry Potter or something. I don't know why. But anyway, I got caught and I got the sack. But I only got caught taking money out of the till. It was a fiver I took out of the till, because I didn't have any money to buy any lunch. So I took a fiver out of the till. But something in me, you know, that spark of hope or whatever it is, or just that a little spiritual awakening, I suppose. I thought, I didn't get caught taking that money because I needed food. I got caught taking that money because I'd spent all my wages that weekend on crack, and so had my ex. And that just went bang. And I phoned my friend Pete, and I was crying my eyes out. And I said, I really, really need help. And he said, Linda, there's meetings for people like you. I'll take you to one of, it's called Narcotics Anonymous. I said, oh, all right then. Okay, I was kind of willing to do anything. And he took me to my first meeting, which was in, Denby Road. It was a Sunday night, and it was Denby Road. And there was a guy there who was doing the chair, and he shared that he'd been locked in a cupboard in Jamaica for 2 weeks smoking crack, and it had been hell. And I thought, what's wrong with him? You got crack on tap, you're in Jamaica, you know, it sounded like heaven to me. So honestly, that's how wrecked I was. And so I didn't go back for 6 months. I didn't go back. And then it kind of, you know, everything went to shit again. And then I went to Portobello Road meeting, and I sat there, and I couldn't have been more closed in. My legs were crossed, my arms were crossed, my eyes were crossed. I was just like this. I was so, and I sat there quietly, just sort of crying, and sort of sneaked in and sat there, because I'd been given a way to find somewhere along the line. I'd been given one of these, but I used to break my rocks up on it because it really stood up on the book. It took me a couple of weeks to kind of get, you know, and a couple of relapses to kind of get that this, you know, that really I had to do everything that was suggested and not just part of it. I was also in a day program, but that was kind of crack specific. You could drink and you could take Valium and all of that, so that didn't really work for me either. And I was getting pissed, even though alcohol had never been a huge thing for me. I've always liked drugs more than booze. I know alcohol is a drug, but that's just me. And so I did, I thought, right, I want all those key rings. I'm going to be sat there, I'm going to be taking this meeting, I'm going to run. I was off my tiny little mind when I came in. You know, and you touched on it, Ronnie, that I remember, and you made me remember this, it was about 5 months before I could stay in my flat on my own. I would run from meeting to meeting to meeting. I was doing 3 meetings a day when I came out of the day program. I would go to coffee shops with people. I couldn't go home. And when I did, I was like a 5-year-old. I would look under the bed and look in the cupboards in case the boogeyman was there or something. I was terrified like a child. And I remember clearly the day that I actually felt okay. And I was at home. There was some crap on the telly, and I was reading a crappy magazine. And I felt content. I didn't feel scared. And I went to my first NA camp out. And there's people sort of sitting around a fire playing guitars and everything. And I didn't, for once in my life, do that and kind of that, and just look to see what was behind me, what was going to get me. I was comfortable. And that comfort has grown and grown and grown. You know, I get really, I'm going to be honest, I get really pissed off with NA. I get really pissed off with the people in NA. I'm in an area where there's a lot of really young women and I find it difficult because they take their mummy shit out on me. You know, I don't know half of them. You walk in and they go, give you a dirty, I don't, oh, I just, you know, it just pisses me off. So I have this love-hate relationship sometimes with the fellowship, but when I think back to what my life was like before and the hellish at times existence, you know, that you're a teenage girl on the streets, you don't go, you know, it's standard that you fight for your life sometimes, it's standard that you get raped, it's standard that you fucking have to bottle people to stay alive, you know, that's was my reality, and I never had anyone to take me through all of that stuff. I started to look at it when I came into NA, but I believe it was too much for me back then. So I was, I remember I got 7.5 years clean, abstinent, I will say. I wasn't clean. I was abstinent for 7.5 years in this program because I threw myself into it, but I was acting out left, right and center. I was seeing two men at the same time. I was shoplifting because that's all I knew. Every time I got a feeling, I would float up to Oxford Street and nick a bottle of perfume or, you know, nick something. I would come home with bags, loads of shit, and just look at it. There's a guy in the rooms called Billy. Me and him used to turn up on a Monday night to a meeting up in St. Giles, and we'd both have massive bags. And we'd be like, all right. And I shared it one day. He went, that's what I do. I mean, I was 5 years clean. It was ridiculous. I didn't know, I will say this, that at that time I was doing the best that I knew how to do. I didn't know any different. I'd been like that since I was 15 years old. I came into recovery when I was 44 years old. I started using at 13. You know, I'm going to be 60 next year. So I've done quite well to get there, I think. And people, I did share it, and I told people what I was doing. I told my sponsor, and I said, well, I nicked today. She said, what did you nick? I said, some sushi. She said, that's terribly Notting Hill, darling. You couldn't just buy a tin of beans. I went, no, I can't. You know, just, I was always doing stuff like that. Anyway, I relapsed like everybody said I would, and I didn't believe them, and I did. And I relapsed for 8 months, and, you know, it was, more than anything, it was really boring. It was just me sitting in the house on my own having a little drink. I remember the first night when I got drunk and I sat at my laptop and I deleted everybody in NA that I was like, delete, he's a cunt and she can fuck off and this one. I was just like that, knocking it back, you know. And I spent 8 months in my flat on my own like that, you know, sort of feeling bitter and twisted, really. And luckily, I don't think I have much in the way of pride, I'm not sure, but it didn't take anything for me to come back, because I thought everybody who cares about me, and including myself, just wanted me to come back to NA. And, you know, those that don't matter, really, I didn't care about. I didn't really think about anybody else then. I just thought, I need to go back to meetings. And that was 6 years ago in on August the 10th. I was 6 years clean on August the 10th. And this 6 years has been very, very different. I've been in therapy for the last almost 3 years now, because I realised there was a lot to work through. And I've got this woman, and she's brilliant. And, you know, alongside doing everything in the fellowship, I, you know, when I came back from that relapse, I got myself my sponsor that I still have now. No, I didn't, actually. I got another woman, first of all, for 6 weeks, and then she was completely mental, more than me. And I just thought, this is not going to work. I'm not having this. And then I came here to this meeting, and I found my sponsor. You know, do the steps. I have a sponsor. I have commitments. I sponsor people. I've done everything, but I did all that the first time. That wasn't enough. This time, I really, instead of just sort of writing everything and academically doing it, this time I've felt it, and I don't know what's different. I'll share this. The last 2 years, right, okay, this is a biggie for me. I smoked cigarettes for over 40 years. Tomorrow is 3 years since I gave up nicotine. You know, I cannot believe I don't take antidepressants, I don't take drugs, I don't drink alcohol, I haven't had a partner for 6 years, because of course there was a man involved in my relapse, obviously. I'm, you know, no antidepressants, no cigarettes, no nothing. There is nothing. There's me and rawness. And sometimes I can't handle that. And I'll go into a meeting with a face on me and people go, hi, Linda, hi, Linda. And I just think, I don't want to be noticed sometimes. I just want to walk into a meeting, sit down and be anonymous in that meeting and just allow myself to feel. You know, I cry a lot. It's 2 years next week that my mum died. That was massive. I had a really bad relationship with my mum. Really quite abusive relationship with my mum. You know, I used to share when I first came in, my mum was beating me up when my dad was touching me up. And, you know, it wasn't as extreme as that, but that did kind of happen. So you don't feel very safe in the world growing up, and it's no wonder I kind of got out when I did. But, you know, my therapist has made me look at things differently as well. She says to me, I think you're a remarkable woman with remarkable strength. She said, because you got out. You didn't let your mother suffocate you like she did with your sisters. You didn't let her do that to you. You actually got out. And I thought, oh, yeah, and that really changed my perspective on myself and what I'm capable of and how strong I am. Yeah, this time in recovery, I've been to Thailand, been to India, I've been to Palermo, I've been to Prague a couple of times. I'm going to Budapest next week. I was at a farm in Glastonbury last week with my little grandson, my older sister and her grandson, and that was lovely, just sloshing about in the mud and, you know, having fun on go-karts, dragging kids up hills on go-karts and shit like that, and having good country stuff, which I had when I was a kid. Yeah, it's been immense. My uncle died. First of all, after my dad died 9 years ago, my uncle, I was very close to, he would, when I'd go home to Wales, he would be the person that would pick me up, because I'm like right in the hills. He'd come and pick me up from the train station 30 miles away and stuff. And he died, and it really affected me when my Uncle John died. It was really sad. And then 6 weeks after him, my cousin died, his son, and he was only 46. They both died of cancer. And I came back from my cousin Steve's funeral, and my mum started to be, you know, not well, feel not well. And she was in hospital for 2.5 weeks, and they found out she had a rare form of acute myeloid leukemia, which is really quite aggressive. And they told her that she had that after 2.5 weeks, and 3 weeks later she was dead. And it just went bang, 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 bang. And one of my sisters was using and causing chaos, and the other one was blaming the two that my mum wanted to look after her. And, you know, there was all this shit going on, and I just felt like I didn't have anybody, because there was, my family is such a fuck up. And but I did. I had you lot in NA, and, you know, I've got four really, really close friends. One of them's a gay man, one of them's a straight man, and the other two are women. And I absolutely love them, and they love me. And, you know, they were there for me. And that's what got me through that happening. And it was really dark with my therapy and my sponsor as well. It was a really, really dark time. And last year, this time last year, I thought, you know, I went to Prague for 4 days, and I stayed for 3 weeks. And I had a tattoo, which I'm quite proud of my tattoo. It's to do with my mum. And I made friends with the tattoo artist and his girlfriend, and I went out with them, and I made friends over there, and I went to a couple of AA meetings because it wasn't an NA meeting. And I had this really, and for the first time in a while, I started to feel like myself, started to feel okay. And I came back at Christmas, and then my best friend Carol died. She just had, her and my little sister had both been in hospital. My sister had a breakdown after my mum died, and Carol, they thought, had a breakdown. And Carol was in this fellowship. Turned out she'd had cancer in her brain, and she had a massive stroke, and she died. And I got to go to the hospital and hold her hand and say goodbye to her and tell her how much I loved her.
And then her son and I left, went to a meeting on the Thursday night, and then her son phoned me and said she's gone, and it was 2 hours after I'd left. It's been so hard. And then Chris, who was a big member of this fellowship, who kind of lived around the corner from me and helped me. I studied drama when I was first clean, and Chris used to cut. Well, I needed a northern accent for something I was doing, and he came round. So I've got his voice on a recorder at home. Then he died. So I've been to 5 funerals this year and 4 before. So it's been the hardest 2 years of my life. But weirdly enough, all that loss, all that grief, without anything there to buffer, it's just ripped me open. It's ripped me open, and I'm quite glad it has, because I feel like a softer person, I feel like a gentler person, I feel like more me than I accept myself more than I ever have before in my entire life. It's just been immense. And as much as I can sit here and go, oh God, that one pisses me off if I go to that meeting, or that one pisses me off if I go to that meeting, and try and back myself up, because I do that. If I've got resentment with one person in a meeting and I see them talking to, I was at the ASC last night. One of my relatives was there, and we don't get on, we don't talk. I saw somebody talking to her. I now hate that person. I now hate the ASC. I do the tea there. I'm going to pack that in now, right? And then before long, I will back myself out of NA. That's what I do. That's how I work. It's, I walk around just, but I'm glad I've got the knowledge that that's what I do now. Because I didn't know that at one time. I just change areas all the time. I do things like I'll get up and put my headphones in, and I'll walk down the road, and I will just not feel good. I'll just feel a bit aggy. Someone will be in my way, and I'll think, why are you standing at the top of the stairs on the tube? You're clearly a moron. And sometimes that slips out of my mouth as I walk past and go, moron, and they're like probably Austrian tourists who haven't got a clue. And then I get on the tube and I think, oh, fuck that, I clearly deserve a seat when nobody, there's all the seats are taken, where's my seat, all of that. And then I'll get on the tube and I'll go to a meeting, and I'll sit down in a meeting and I'll cry. And I'll just sit there and I'll cry. And I think, what's going on? And then I'll realise that it's my son's birthday. That stuff will come up. And I feel safe enough to do that now. To go to a meeting, to sit there and just let it out. Because I used to not, I was not going to let you see me do that. I was not going to let anyone see me cry. I was not going to let anyone hear me vulnerable. I don't care anymore. I think what the death of everyone lately has done is made me realise how, and clearly being, prescribed as dead today, tapped into all that shit. It's like life is short. Soon they're going to stop my housing benefits because I'm dead. And it's time to just get on with it and be myself. And if you like me, you like me. And if you don't, you don't. And who cares? The whole world isn't going to like me. I don't like the whole world. I really don't care anymore about that stuff. What I care about is my family, my daughter, my grandsons, my friends, and travel. That's what I really care about. I love traveling. I love meeting new people. And I love that freedom. And, if you'd asked me when I first came into recovery what I wanted to be a famous actress. I wanted to have a boyfriend, that didn't take drugs. And now what I want is freedom. Freedom from self-obsession. I no longer want to be in a relationship. The thought of that terrifies me, because I'm a lunatic when I'm in a relationship. I get so scared, Yeah, I'm working on it. So maybe one day, maybe one day, maybe when I'm 75, I don't know. I'll need someone to help me with my Zimmer frame, who knows. But yeah, for now, you know, I'm a happy bunny. And, it, you know, none of that stuff, the therapy, the awareness, the travel. I did travel when I was using, you know, I got away with a lot. I take a lot of drugs abroad as well. Yeah. But, I always looked innocent. That was the good thing about me. I looked innocent, never was. But, none of that would happen without me having found this or having the courage to say to my friend Pete that day, can you take me with you to one of those AA places that you go? And he said, NA, you know, so I'll leave it there. I think I've spoken enough, and thank you.